Welcome to the Teachers Unify podcast. I'm Sarah Lerner. This extended episode features Melissa Gibbons, a teacher at Oxford High School in Oxford, Michigan. She speaks about her experience from November 30th, 2021, how she's using her voice to speak out, and much more. So I would like to welcome Melissa Gibbons, who is a teacher at Oxford High School in Oxford, Michigan. She has been with her district for 24 years, braved middle school for 13, has been at Oxford now, the high school, for 11, and teaches junior and senior English. So as a fellow English teacher, I would like to welcome you to our little show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I always like to start with your family, your background, like what led you to teaching. So you can take it away.
Okay. So I really, I grew up in a family of teachers. My dad and my stepmom at the time, they taught at my middle school. That was kind of the furthest thing from my mind was going into teaching. And so I never really saw myself going into teaching, but all my work experience related around children, babysitting, running summer camp programs. And so as a freshman in college, I actually was a chemistry and biology major. I did okay, but it was more about like, I all of a sudden was like, wait a minute, I have to be in a lab by myself for like 2-3 hours. Like, that's no fun. And so it kind of started to dawn on me that the more science classes I take, I have to take more lab classes and kind of be I mean, I know I'm not isolated, but it just was a different kind of work than what I had been used to with babysitting and all those day camps and stuff. And so kind of the end of my freshman year, I was like, yeah, I'm just not feeling the vibe of the sciences anymore. And I've always loved to read and write. And I decided, you know, I think I might pursue English. And then it's, you know, okay, what do you do with an English degree? You either teach or you go into law school. And so at that point, I was like, yeah, maybe I'll take some education classes. And, you know, I can remember having a conversation with my brother at one point that summer. And I said, yeah, I think I'm going to go into education. And he was like, yeah, you should have been in that program in the first place, just because my entire existence really was all about kids. And so once I made that switch and, you know, started taking the English classes and history classes and education classes, then I found my experience in college was much more rewarding. And so I graduated and I did a semester of student teaching. And then I came home and I was subbing. I, you know, did what everybody did, trying to look for jobs. And over that summer, late in the summer, I ended up getting hired in Oxford. Oxford is in Oakland County in Michigan, and I'm an Oakland County girl. So I pretty much moved, about 40 minutes from where I grew up. and that's pretty much where I've been. But my dad was a teacher for 34 years. My two stepbrothers are teachers, both in nearby communities. One of my cousins is a teacher. And so it just kind of was a natural fit for me. And that's kind of, I've been doing teaching in Oxford for 24 years.
That's impressive. Like, this is your, this is year 22 for me, and it feels like a lifetime. And yeah. I was telling my husband, we've been talking about when I'll actually be able to retire, which of course will be never. But like, I think I have about 8 to 10 years left. And when I say it, it like sounds so stupid. Like, it sounds like a prison sentence,
yes.
But that's, you know, I've got 8 to 10. So right. 24, good for you.
Right. Right. And I'm thinking like, okay, I've got 6 years, but then it's like, no, I really don't. I have probably 8 to 10 as well, you know, realistically. Yeah.
It is quite fitting that you became a teacher. Like, clearly you come from a long line of teachers. Mm-hmm. My mom went to college and her degree is in elementary ed, with an emphasis on ESOL. And my mother-in-law was a teacher. My uncle was a teacher. So it seems like those of us in the profession are drawn to it because we see so many people in our lives who have done this and clearly love it, because you said your dad was a teacher for 34 years. Like, good for him. That's a long time. So I want to move into that day, however much you're comfortable talking about, but I would like you to share your experience from November 30th of 2021.
Okay. As part of that family of teachers, so I actually married a teacher who actually we met in Oxford. We have been married 20 years. So he actually is the band director at the high school. So we teach together. During November of 21, all three of our children were in the building as well. Well, not all three were in the building. They were all students in the building. So we have at that time, we had twins who were seniors, and then we had a freshman, all three girls. Our youngest, our freshman, the night before, she started feeling sick. And, again, COVID was still rampant. And so at that point, we're like, maybe she needs to stay home and take a, do COVID and get that checked out. And so my husband stayed home with her that day. Which, that's, I think, the first time that I've been able to say thank God for COVID. And so that morning, it was just kind of like mostly a normal day. My husband still kind of got up and, was doing some work, even though he was going to take her to the doctor. The twins and I did our thing and went to school. And then, kind of, I mean, everything was fairly normal. I had a lunch, and so that was the first lunch. And so I went to lunch with, my class, and then we came back and started class, and we had, a normal class period that day. Then, like after fourth hour ended, that was passing time. And during that time, we would have music play when the kids had one more minute to get to class. It's one of those things that I know exactly what time it was because class started at 12:52 and the music started playing. So I know, like, it's one of those, we know it started at 12:51. Where my room is located, I'm in a really small hallway. There are four of us teachers in my hallway, and we connect to one of the main hallways. And all of a sudden, I always stand at the same spot, kind of that cross part of the two hallways. I'm not a hunter. I've never really been around guns much, but I knew like that's gunshot. And then all of a sudden I saw and heard kids running around the corner. At that point I was like, get in the classrooms, get in the classrooms. And so by that point, most of my students were already in my class, but there were a few extras that I just said, get in, get in. And so, I do remember, I think, counting that day. And, I think that during that class, I think I had about 31 students and I had about 35 in my classroom at that point. And, I was like, okay, asking the kids, what class should you be in? I'll text the teacher right now that you're safe, whatever. And my classroom is kind of a funny setup. It's like just a funny, like diamondy shape classroom almost. And so we immediately went into the back corner and the kids were great. And, it was one of those like, you just kind of instinctively do what you've been taught to do. We had the night lock system, which for Michigan schools, that was actually kind of fairly, I wouldn't say a new thing because we had had it for years, but even our surrounding districts that are comparable in size and, economy and everything are, they didn't have it yet. And so out of our county, we were one of the very few schools who had it. So the door was locked. I put the night lock in, and I'm having the kids move as far away from the visual field of the small window by the door. And then it kind of dawned on me, like, I didn't pull down the shade. So for years in that classroom, my blinds were broke. So like every year I put in a work order to get the blinds fixed and they never were fixed. Well, then like I think 2 or 3 years ago, or like before the shooting, they did install blinds, that you just pull down and it's like a shade. That was the one thing I didn't do. And I said to the kids, I have my eye on there. I don't want you to worry about it. I have my eye. And, I felt like, shoot, that's the one thing I forgot is the blinds. But I told them I can't go over there because I have no idea who or what is over by the door, and I'd have to pass by the door. And so we're just going to have to, it's good enough. And it was really weird being with the kids because so many of them were like, is this real? Is this real? Well, I remember I heard the principal say, this is not a drill. Some other teachers said that they heard otherwise, that he said, this is a drill. And it's just interesting how, depending on kind of what you could hear or what you wanted to hear, I guess, I don't know. But I thought I heard, this is not a drill. And so I just kept composure of the kids and just said, we'll figure this out, but we got to stay quiet. I don't want you talking, And then at that moment, once we kind of got calmed down as much as you can be calmed down in that situation, it dawned on me that where the shots came from was the exact hallway where my twins were supposed to be. So at that point, it registered to me where my children should have been at that time. They were going to their fifth hour class. They were actually in a class together. And then my heart sank because I was like, I know where they should be. And it's like very close to where the gunshots came from. So then again, this is another thing, thank God for cell phones that I was able to have, constant communication with them just by the cell phone. My one daughter said, and this at this point, like I didn't know, like, okay, what is actually going on? But she said, we're not locked down. And I said, okay, well, you got to be locked. Like, and so I think there was kind of a delay. And so then I'm texting my principal saying, this room is not in lockdown. My daughters are both in there. And then I got a text from my other daughter saying, yep, we're locked down now. We're okay. What is going on? I said, I really don't know. But, just stay low, stay safe, whatever. Well, as it turned out, they were in a classroom that was shot into. That night, I knew that. What I didn't know until the week after, so their teacher, and I knew this part. So their teacher actually wasn't in the classroom because it was passing time. Everybody was doing their hall duty. You're instructed to, if something happens, then get into the nearest room. Well, the nearest room was not his room. And so he did what he was trained to do, get into the nearest room. And so the kids were actually by themselves. And there were, I think, like three or four other classrooms throughout the building that the kids were by themselves. And this one particular student, once he kind of realized like they were all kind of hidden away, he realized that the night lock wasn't in. So he went and put the night lock in. And so then I get a text from my girls that this one student put the night lock in. I'm like, okay, like at that point, I could kind of breathe. Like once I knew what I didn't know until the week after was that the way my girls were texting me, I thought the night lock was in like almost immediately. Like it wasn't right when the door was shut, but then not long after. That was not the case. The shooter shot into the classroom. And at that point, when he shot into the classroom, had he tried to open the door, he would have gotten in. And I didn't know that for until the next week. And there's probably a reason why I did not know that information, because I don't think I could have handled that night to know that part of it. It seemed like we were in lockdown for hours. I feel like, okay, this was like a 3 hour experience. My classroom was in lockdown for 45 minutes. Like I was in one of, just because of where my room was in comparison to where the shooting happened. We were in there for about 45 minutes. My daughters, they said they were in there for about an hour because they had to make sure that anybody who was injured got out before the kids. And then they did kind of just, tarp the damage in the hall and everything. When we were able to evacuate, I had, and like my English teachers, we were all like texting each other, like, what's going on? And my one friend, he seemed to have like a pretty good eye on like the doorway and who was walking by and everything. And so he said, there's police that are starting to come and evacuate. And so I can remember being in the corner, not being able to see through the small window. And there's this banging on the door. And like I didn't trust that it was the sheriff's. And so I told the kids, I said, you guys stay there, do not move. I'm going to like scoot my way to make sure. Well, this was also an intimidating part because I go to the window and there are four men with gigantic guns. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's definitely SWAT. But I didn't believe them at first. So then at that point, I was like, okay, like nobody's injured, we're okay. And he said, okay, like I want you to open the door, get the night lock, whatever. And the thing that I found interesting was the SWAT team, the sheriffs, they were so calm and not like yelling at the kids. When you watch the movies, you see like, get down. And they did ask the kids to put their hands up. They said, just leave all your belongings, put your hands up. But nobody was yelling, nobody was pushing them. And, they were really just, please be quiet. Please walk in a straight line, hands up, make your way out to the front door, head to Meyer. And so I thought that was just really weird because you envision that moment to be so chaotic and lots of yelling, and it wasn't, which I appreciate because I think the kids, were somewhat comforted in that moment. But at the same time, you have these men with machine guns lining the hallway, escorting everybody out. Like it's a very weird thing. And then at about the same time that I was out, my daughters had texted that they were then being evacuated, but they were going through the other side. And I said, okay. One of my friends who teaches at the middle school, she happened to be off that day, and she ended up coming up to the high school right away when, like, all of this. She has a son who is my youngest age. So she had a son who was a freshman. So she came and she happened to see my girls. So she grabbed my girls, her son, and another friend. And I said, no, please, like, take them home, take them to your house, wherever you need to. Like, if you can get them out of there, take them. And so once she had them safe and she took them home, then I was like, okay, now I can breathe. Because I knew at that point, then my own children were safe. And then, so while all of this is going on, so my husband and my youngest, they're still at home, or they were at home at that point. And I texted my husband right when we got into lockdown and everything, and I said, gunshots for real. And he tried calling, and I texted like, no, don't call, text. So he and I spent a lot of time texting, and then he was also texting with our twins too. Well, we don't live that far from a main road that runs through Oxford. And so he said, oh my God, sirens, sirens, sirens. And so where we are, he said, you could just, that's all you could hear for minutes upon minutes upon minutes is, ambulance, fire trucks, police cars. At that point, he's like, okay, I'll meet you at Meyer. Because that was kind of like our unofficial meeting place. Like, we were always taught and told the kids, like, if something happens, go to Meyer. Well, Meyer, the grocery store, they really weren't told that information. So I was kind of like, hey, surprise, we have to evacuate. And they were amazing. They basically shut down the store, cleared everybody out, and completely let our staff take over and the sheriff's office take over. They were just, it was amazing. So now there is kind of a plan in place with them. And, so my husband came up to Meyer. And at that point, it was just like we made the walk. It's probably maybe a good, 5, 6 minute walk from school to to Meyer's parking lot. And at that point, we tried to like organize as much as we could. We tried to, we had the secretaries came down and they had like just packets of, the registration of kids and trying to sort through, checking off, when your parents leave. And it was somewhat of an organized chaos, but at the same time, like, I don't even know if we're even making a dent in what we should be doing. I don't know. And so at that point, though, my husband, not only is he a band director, he's also the union president. All the high school administrators were at the high school. So he actually kind of took over as the de facto administrator at that point. And because he wasn't in the building, he kind of had a clear mind. And so he worked with the sheriff's department on trying to like have it more of an organized situation, and then other staff members who were in a clear enough mind to help organize things and try to make sure kids got where they needed to be. And so I stuck around there knowing that my own three kids were home safe and fine. So I tried to stick around for a while, but then at some point I was like, okay, I just need to get home. And so once I got home, it was this complete haze of what did we just experience and what did we go through and like, did this really happen? And then when I came in and all three of my kids are there, and then it's on the news. And in the meantime, my cell phone is blowing up and, texts from everybody. And my brother who lives in North Carolina, he's like, are you okay? Are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, how did you hear about this? And he said, this is like national news stuff, because again, I'm listening to and paying attention to our Metro Detroit stations. I'm not really hearing and seeing the reach of this. And so when I got home, then it's like on all the news channels, it's like NBC, CNBC, CNN, like everything. And it was just like a really weird, like, what is actually going on? And so I can remember that night, like, just being in such a daze and a fog of not really like, did we really just go through this? And then, word obviously started to get out about the students who were killed. Funny enough, I never had actually any of the four, but I did have siblings. I had Justin's older brother, I had Hannah's older sister, and I had Tate's two older brothers, but I never had the three of them. And so I was very much like connected to their siblings. And then Madison, I didn't have her siblings, but she has cousins in the community. And so I had cousins of her. And so it was really weird because I didn't have a personal relationship with the children themselves, but I knew exactly their families and like how this was going to devastate those four families. Then when it started to hear about, just other people being injured, and Molly, she's one of my dear friends, and so then word started to get around about, I think Molly was the teacher that was shot, and it was just all like, wait, what? I was texting with her, and she said she was fine, that she was, she heard stuff, but and so, knowing her story, it was, she just didn't want anybody else to worry at that moment. And so just the whole night seemed like a blur. And we came home, my husband ended up coming home, and we ended up having the other band directors over, and we just like got pizza, but like nobody wanted to eat. And it was just, and I think I was certainly in a whole fog, really. And I can remember over Christmas break, we didn't want to do much with any of the family. I just can't. And then I remember it was the Sunday that I think we were supposed to go back to school the next Monday. So it was like right after the new year, what should have been the Monday that we would have gone back. And all of a sudden, I kind of just popped out. Like, I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to grade today. And, but I mean, it took that long. It took, over a month. It was probably about 6 weeks at that point that I was in a complete fog, not really myself by any means at all.
First, I want to thank you for sharing your story because I know how difficult it can be. There's so much to unpack here. Listening to your story, and I was nodding along the whole time, it is almost identical to mine.
Really?
Yes, which, I've shared my story a million times. I ended up with kids in my classroom who weren't mine. I mean, I was in my room a lot longer than you were. I was in my room for about 2.5, 3 hours. But at one point, the phone rang in my classroom. And I'm pretty sure it was my husband trying to call, but I told him to text, not call. My phone was blowing up the whole time that we were in my room, just trying to like go point by point of like what similarities. I had 8 SWAT members, armed and large men who let themselves in the room, and I had to identify myself as the teacher. The kids were able to take their bags, but they had to leave them before we went down the stairs. I mean, I went to the staging area. My husband is not a teacher, which is a good thing for all of us because he probably would have been fired on day one. I went to the staging area and met up with him and my son, who was in sixth grade at the middle school next door at the time. He's now a senior. And I was texting with him the whole time. And my daughter was in third grade and had no idea what was going on, which was fine because I didn't want her to hear about this. I went to Moe's with one of the students who was with me the whole time, because she couldn't get a hold of her mom. And the Moe's was very close to the staging area at the Marriott, about a quarter mile from school. And I walked in, and if you've ever been to Moe's, they have TVs everywhere. And it's usually like sports or like other things. Every single TV was CNN. It's live coverage of my school, which is a quarter mile away. But I'm watching this, it could have been your school, it could have been anyone else's school. And it was totally surreal. And I understand the ordering pizza and not wanting to eat. Like, I went through the line at Moe's to make my veggie burrito. And I sat there just in a fog, like you said. And that's the shock. And it takes a while for the fog to lift, for me at least. I don't think I fully processed what happened for days. And like, I knew what happened because like I was there. It's surreal. It's so hard to process what you have just experienced. Adding to that, having your own children at the school and all of these other layers that if your other daughter had been there, if your husband had been there, if the night lock wasn't put on where your twins were, like all of these what ifs, I mean, you can make yourself crazy thinking about them. The fact that the three of you made it home safely, even though the room where your girls were was shot into, the fact that your husband and daughter, younger daughter, weren't at school, you had the wherewithal to keep the kids quiet and all of that, which is what I did too. I'm like, do not make a sound. You could have heard a pin drop in my classroom. I don't remember when it was, but like someone tried, like jiggled the door handle to my classroom. And the kids all looked at me. I had 15 kids with me, 10 of mine and five from the teacher next door. And they looked at me and I'm like, don't even think about it. If they need to get in this room, they will have a key and they will get in. And yeah, all of the information I was getting was from people on the outside. And like anyone who has ever had my number from like the dawn of time was texting me, listening to you. And I've spoken with Amy Stevens from your school and, other teachers who have joined this shitty club after me, after you, and people before. All of our stories are honestly so similar, which is bizarre because the circumstances are different. Everything you were saying, and I had my mic muted, but everything you were saying, I was like, check, check, check. Like that all happened to me. And when this airs, it will be after the fact. But next Wednesday is the 6 year mark for us. It's like it was yesterday, but also like it was a lifetime ago. I appreciate you sharing your story. I don't know if you do it often or have even done it before.
I have, it's one of those things. I'm typically a fairly private person. And so how I got all wrapped up in MEA, NEA is kind of somewhat of a fluke. They actually, the MEA contacted my husband and wanted some teachers, to talk with or interview, or whatever. Well, he was supposed to be one of them that they wanted, but he was not able to do it. And so he said, well, you should do it. And I was like, no, he's definitely more like the visible face of the family. And I'm like behind the scenes. He said, no, I really think you should. And he said, and really, like, you have a compelling story because you were there with our children. That he said, my story is I was sitting home worried about you. And, we had a COVID kid that day. And he said, you really should do this. And I was like, All right. And so, you know, I started to share my story with MEA and NEA. And part of it, I do think it is important, the connection of, you know, I know Amy Stevens too. It's the same, you know, her both of her daughters were in the building as well. And so it's, I want people to see that we as teachers, yes, we are teachers and we're having our classrooms, but at the same time, many of us also had our own children to worry about. And, you know, I think for me, that's really, I want people to see that, like, when we have these situations, you have people who have to play multiple roles. And so I'm worrying about your children while one of my colleagues is worried, you know, dealing with my own children. And so, like, that's part of it is just sharing that story of in the moment, yes, I'm a teacher in charge of this classroom of kids in lockdown, but I'm also texting my own children who I knew were in the direct way of where the gunshots were coming from. But then I also think, like, it is part of my responsibility as a survivor to try to make change. That the more people hear these stories and hear that, you know, if our communities can be affected, any community can be affected. And, you know, I kind of stayed pretty quiet, but then it was really after Uvalde that I was like, you know, when is this going to stop? You know, I had really just started to kind of like heal and process from ours. And then in that May, I was like, oh my gosh. And then I just got really angry. And then at that point is when MEA and NEA, you know, kind of were reaching out. And I was like, yep, okay, all right, I'll do it.
Unlike you, I have been vocal from the jump. That's just who I am. Like, I'm loud, I'm outspoken. I'm Sarah Lerner and I do what I want. And I started doing interviews and everything the following day because I knew that it was our story to tell and we needed to control the narrative. We formed Teachers Unify to End Gun Violence in the days after the shooting at your school. So Abby Clements, who's one of the co-founders, she's a Sandy Hook school survivor, me, and then Sari Beth Rosenberg, who is a teacher in New York City. We were in this group chat and, you know, this is the origin story. And it was probably December 1st. And we were like so shaken and horrified by what you all had just experienced. And two of the three of us had previously experienced it. And we're like, this is absurd. We need to do something about this because we knew that the teacher voice has been absent from any gun violence conversations. And we are literally at the front lines of all of this. So we created Teachers Unify to End Gun Violence. And then after Uvalde, Abby and I were invited to Houston through AFT, you know, to speak on a panel with Texas lawmakers. The three of us had been working with AFT and Randy Weingarten for some time, but I am both an AFT union member and I'm also an NEA union member. I met Becky Pringle for the first time and, you know, had the opportunity to talk to her. And, you know, I read the piece that you were included in with NEA Today, We Can Change This, Educators' Take on Gun Violence. I applaud you for speaking out and sharing your truth. And I firmly agree that people need to hear these stories. And as uncomfortable as it may make them, you can't turn a blind eye to this because, as I've said for almost 6 years now, like it shouldn't have happened at my school, but it should have stopped at my school. And here we are, you and I, in a perfect world, shouldn't know each other. And now we do because of this. What has the response been from the NEA piece? Because it was just released on January 5th, so fairly recently.
I have had other people reach out thanking me for sharing a story. A couple other people wanting me to get active with them, you know, but more than anything, I think it's just giving more, you know, voice to like, this is still an issue. Again, I'm typically a fairly private person. And so then when some of my friends or family, you know, take a screenshot and send a picture of me in this national magazine. You know, it is very weird, but at the same time, I feel like, okay, like maybe this now is, you know, like, okay, I'm not done raising kids because I still have a junior, but you know, she's pretty solid. I don't have to be hovering. So maybe this is now my new calling of, you know, we have to try to end this.
Having been so outspoken my entire life, speaking out and doing these things has been helpful for me in my healing and moving through the trauma and the PTSD that I was diagnosed having. And, you know, I take anxiety meds every day, but talking about this, at some level, I find it empowering.
Yeah,
because it's my story.
I
and
agree.
I tell it when I want, how I want, to who I want, and I don't have to do it on anyone else's terms but my own. That is empowering. And I, you know, I'm glad that I get to do that, and whoever wants to listen, listen.
Right.
But immediately after the shooting at your school, like I had the opportunity, I was approached by the New York Times and I wrote a guest essay that was published. And, you know, like as a journalism teacher and a journalist, I'm like, that's dope. But I wish
it could have been on something else.
Right? Like it's framed and I'm proud of it. And like, you know, but at the same time, I wish I wasn't kind of this de facto quasi authority on gun violence. But, you know, as I said, talking about these things and writing those pieces and any interview I've done over the past 6 years, it's been so cathartic for me, where so many of my coworkers and students who have all since graduated, like they choose not to talk about it, which is fine. And totally their choice. And I am loud enough for all of us. But I find it to be helpful where other people find it to be intrusive and overwhelming and all of that. While this side of it has been helpful for my mental health, how have you taken care of yourself and your mental health?
I would definitely agree that I think telling my story, you know, it is an empowering piece, and knowing that I could potentially make change or help make change down the road, or, you know, as these things continue, and, you know, that is empowering. It will be funny for many people to hear this, that really my therapy are my dogs. We have three labs. We have a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and an almost 2-year-old. You know, dogs are completely loyal. And, you know, while I'm trying, and I think it's also helped my own children too, you know, like we obviously kept tabs on all three of our kids. And, you know, some of them, one daughter needed like therapy as time went on. We're like, oh yeah, you know, this is definitely, she was remembering more than the other one. I think the other twin kind of shut her brain down. And so as they were waking up, so to speak, of the trauma, the one who saw more was remembering more. And so she's the one who still, you know, is seeing a therapist and she's processing. And the other one, I think, is a lot like me in the sense that the therapy really comes from the dogs. And, you know, it was just, I don't know really what it was, that I knew that I was in a fog. And I think as a family, we made certain decisions that, you know, we weren't going to participate in bigger family gatherings. We weren't going to do this, you know, like 4th of July is a big thing in my family. And I said, we're not coming. And I can't remember if that first year, if we may have gone down just for the barbecue during the day, but then we left. And she's like, well, why? It's just fireworks. I'm like, no, it's not. Fireworks are not just fireworks anymore. And I said, you know, here's the thing, like at Disney, fireworks are fireworks because, you know, they're shooting them off. You know that it's only Disney and, you know, like that's it. But when you are at a small town America, July 4th fireworks, yes, they have scheduled fireworks, but there's also people all throughout the town doing fireworks. And I don't know when those are going to happen and occur and, all of that. So I think more than anything, as a family, we kind of made certain decisions on the things we were going to do and the things we weren't going to do for our own healing. And it was one of those. And I still kind of feel that some friends, some family may not necessarily understand the decisions we made then or even some of the decisions that we're making now. But I think as a family, that was part of our whole healing, is that we just decided, if one doesn't feel comfortable, we're just gonna like we're then we won't go, or we'll go for the barbecue and then we'll come, if not everybody's feeling comfortable. And because again, they were only kids at that time,
I was going to say, I think it's important to make those family decisions, especially given your situation where all five of you were directly impacted. My anniversary is July 4th, and this year we'll be married 20 years. And I've always hated neighborhood fireworks. And again, the similarities between us, I've always hated fireworks. My neighbors are the worst. And I live 3 hours from Disney. Disney fireworks have never bothered me. They're magical. And you know exactly when they're coming and you know exactly when they'll end. There are no jump scares and it's Disney and it's great. Even like the city fireworks or like local municipalities, like you know what time it starts, you know what time it ends. It's the neighborhood stuff that gets me. It used to get so bad. That, and I will use a Bewitched reference for anyone of a certain age, but I felt very much like Gladys Kravitz, like looking out the window. And like at a certain point, I would call the local, the police non-emergency number. And I'm like, look, it is whatever time it is. I am a school shooting survivor. Like, enough is enough. Like, it sounds like a war zone outside of my house. And even though intellectually you know it's your neighbors being assholes setting off fireworks, in your head, that's not what it sounds like. And we have gotten to the point where my daughter dances and her national competition is in July in Orlando, and it always starts July 6th. A few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, we started going up on the 4th because, like, I don't even want to be home when it happens. And like, it has put such like a wet blanket on my anniversary because the years between the shooting and when we started heading up to Orlando early, I was a nervous, anxious ball of mush all day. I was on edge. I was snapping. Like, how we're still married, I don't know. It like takes the wind out of your sails. And it just made my anniversary so unpleasant. So I completely understand not staying at a family thing. And, where your mom very innocently asked or, said, it's just fireworks. They're never just fireworks.
No,
And
not
I don't
anymore.
know, no, not anymore. And I don't know what it's like where you are, but down here in Florida, because everything goes on down here, it's like the Wild West. I have neighbors who will do some kind of fireworks at the most random times, like on a Thursday. Why? But I hear it and it's off in the distance. And one of the kids will come in, or if they're in the room doing something, will text me. My husband will come in the room. Are you okay? It's stressful and anxiety inducing. We've already established. I know Amy. I'd like to think I've been a support for her in the way that my predecessors have been for me. I check in with her pretty regularly and we've become good friends. Again, someone I'm happy I know, but I wish I didn't know. What is the vibe like at Oxford now, 2 years later? Did a lot of teachers stay? How are the students doing who are still students there?
It's interesting that like we've had people left, but some people left for just, career move positions, right? To become a curriculum director somewhere, like those kinds of things. There have been a couple teachers who left to go teach in districts where their own children
Go to school.
go to school. Yes, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad he's here, right? And so, there have been a couple friends of ours that we've lost in that way, that they have, I feel the need to go be where my kids are. And again, for me, it's absolutely like, I love you, I'll miss you, but yes, go with your kids because I know how fortunate we have been all this time to have our kids and see our kids grad, you know, two of our three kids graduate and a third one on the way next year. We have lost a couple teachers that just are like, I'm just done with education. I just can't handle this responsibility. A couple, one teacher specifically ended up kind of pursuing more in a political fashion. And so she's kind of used this as, well, now I guess it's a good time for me to do something a little bit more active in politics. So we've kind of had like a little bit of everything, but overall, I don't think we've had nearly, you know, I wouldn't say we had a huge exodus out the door. The students, you know, it's interesting because my twins, who were seniors, you know, they had a great send off, I guess you could say. They, you know, again, they were the kids that they had almost like their freshman year was the only normal year of high school because of COVID. And then their senior year, this happened, you know. So, like, that was one of the things with their group that their senior year was like, all right, we're back. We can have normal things again. And so there was kind of a little bit, you know, some excitement. So then when the shooting happened, it was like, and there goes my high school career. And even, you know, one of my twins was like, well, I have a lot to say in a college essay. I'm like, yeah, I guess you will. We made sure, like, the community made sure that they had a great prom, they had a great senior all-night party, graduation, like everything was wonderful. It was a great send-off. And then but it's interesting because they kind of feel like they've been forgotten, that they basically graduated and then went off to college or the workforce or whatever, and that nobody really from the community like has really done much to check on that, which I can see their point, you know, that like, yeah, I think we're going with the attitude of, let's just get them out of here. Let's, you know, they've had a horrible experience anyway. Let's just get them out of here and let them just go on to better things. And so, like, in some ways, I think that was, you know, a good thing, but I think they did feel somewhat cheated. Not that people forgot them, but it was almost like a, how are they really doing? You know, if they didn't have a parent who was nagging them about, are you okay? How's your mental health? You know, that some kids may have felt, well, I don't really know. You know, I don't know. And then the group after them, I think they struggled. I know they struggled a lot. I had in my one class, my sixth hour, I had a lot of Tate's friends. And you could just tell for their senior year, you know, I had some of them as juniors after the shooting. And then I had a lot of them in that 6 hour class, their senior year. And they just were really, they're good kids, they're great kids. Most of them college bound, they knew what they wanted to do, but there was just, they couldn't focus, they couldn't get their act together, they couldn't, you know, it was a weird and very sad thing to see because you know they're acting out because they're hurting. They lost one of their best friends. And so, like, I really struggled with that group all year because I had the kind heart of, I get it, like they lost one of their best friends. But at the same time, I'm like, these kids, you know, they're gonna go off to college next year. Like, I gotta do something. Like, I can't just let them slide in everything. Like, they have to learn this material. They have to realize expectations really matter, you know, and in college, people aren't going to care your story or, you know, what you went through. And so I really had a hard time balancing, especially with that 6 hour group of, you know, having expectations, but also having that kind heart that, like, especially the group of boys, they're hurting a lot. When they graduated, like, it was somewhat a sigh of relief of like, okay, they're at least now out of this building and that they can mourn still on their own how they need to, and they don't have to be confined to the district's, you know, parameters. And you know, and it was really hard because I wanted to like yell at them, but I'm like, I can't yell at you. I understand you're in pain, you're hurting, you're mourning still. Like, I get it. But you know, you need to know this. You need to understand this. And so I kept telling them, you know, certain things that my daughters went through their first year of college. You know, the first week, both of them had kind of odd experiences that really wouldn't be so odd, but after having surviving a school shooting, it seems odd, you know, like a fire alarm going off at 9:30 at night in your dorm your first week. And, you know, it's just like all of these things. And both universities ended up really doing a nice job of once they knew, and this is, I kept telling my students, based on my experiences as a parent of two college kids who survived a high school shooting, you have to tell people, you have to talk to your RA, you have to let your professors know. Like, you have to reach out to people to let them know your experiences, because you need to let them know there are going to be times where I may be shooken up about, from something, and it's not going to make any sense to anybody. And so I kept like, that's kind of how I was like, okay, maybe how I can help them the best, you know, not worrying about their reading or writing, maybe how I can help them the best is give them this advice, just seeing my own kids. Because I do think my children, once they let people know their experience, the colleges were both very accommodating and also just looking out for them. So then that was that group. And the seniors now, I think we are, you know, and again, remember we had COVID too. And so it's like, okay, is some of this scatterbrained behavior, is it a result of COVID, or are we dealing with the shooting issue? You know, like, and then the kids being, I don't want to say behind, because what are they behind of, right? I mean, what is exactly the benchmark? But, you know, is it a COVID thing or is it a shooting thing? And I think that's something in Oxford that we just struggle with, like, because the two of them are so closely linked. And so it's been hard to tease out, is this because the kids developed bad habits during COVID because they didn't have to study as much, or they didn't have to do this? And, you know, we only did this much, or is it the trauma from the shooting? And so I think we're still struggling to tease that apart. But I do think this is really the first year that we do have somewhat of a more normal existence with our kids. And again, like, is that because, you know, we're getting through with COVID more, or is it, you know, we have half the building now who experienced a shooting. And so the freshmen and sophomores, like, they know of it, but they don't have the emotional attachment in the building itself. But I do see, like, I teach juniors and seniors. And so I do see those groups. There is a level of kind of maturity based on the experiences that they had. But I think there's also an awareness of, we can't let this completely define us and hold us back. So it's been interesting. And, you know, having my daughter, you know, I check in with her and kind of get tabs on not just her, but like, how's everybody else feeling? And, you know, whatever. And, you know, there's still sadness, there's still some elements of trauma. But I think there is like that, yes, it's a part of our story, but it can't be our only high school story. Like, we can't let this drown us anymore, you know? And so, like, I kind of feel like they're gonna be okay, I think. And I think our students, just in general, have kind of realized that, like, the power in what they can do for themselves and how they can tell their stories. And you may have experienced this too. You know, a lot of the seniors come asking, or, you know, junior year into senior year, ask about writing their college essays. And a lot of them have written about COVID, a lot of them have written about the shooting. And, you know, I just say, like, I don't want, because a lot of them were like, I think it, I don't want it to sound like it's my sob story, or it's, you know, I'm using it as an excuse of things. I'm like, no, but you have to frame it in the right way. Like, you have to tell your story, but make it yours. And so that's where the power comes from. And so I said, you know, people will appreciate hearing your honesty and the lessons that you've learned and how you're trying to, you know, improve this world based on your experiences. So, you know, I do think in that way, a lot of the kids are processing just by their writing.
So again, similarities. Our kids, the freshmen that day, started out high school that way. Like they had a normal 6 months before the shooting, and then they ended with COVID. So they didn't have a normal high school experience at all. The classes of 18 and 19 had a normal prom, and everyone bent over backwards and went out of their way to make their proms normal. 20 didn't, and 21 had a socially distanced prom, which was interesting, but actually really cool. So like we definitely, like as a school and a community, did a lot for those kids who are now all adults. I think about the ones who were seniors that year because they finished school in such a strange way and then just went to college. And, you know, the ones who were juniors, but especially the freshmen and sophomores, they had resources and therapy dogs and all kinds of stuff at school, good, bad, and otherwise. You know, like the district tried and, you know, everything looked good on paper. How effective it was, I don't know. But, you know, they had all of that stuff. I, like you, have taught some of the siblings of the victims. I had Jamie Guttenberg's brother. She was my student actually that year when she was a freshman. And I had her brother, Jesse, the following year when he was a senior. And Martin Duque, who was a freshman that year, I had his brother, Alex, 2 years later. And there are still siblings and cousins at our school. And even 5 academic years later, I'm still reading college essays that have something to do with the shooting. I mean, and COVID, but you know, specifically the shooting, like my son put it in his college essay. Like I know how much it impacted him, but to now hear it from a 17, almost 18-year-old reflecting on what happened shortly after he turned 12. You know, and all of the work that I've done that I think is important, but you know, to hear it reflected back from your child, you know, like I'm proud of my mom and like, you know, the change she's trying to make. And it like, on one level, it like just warms your heart to know that like my kid loves me and like, look at this. But at the same time, like, how screwed up is this? That this is what is part of his college essay. So, you know, I've read these things over the years as an English teacher because I only teach seniors. And, you know, to then have to read it and not only my son's essay this year, but all of his friends who had siblings who were on campus that day or have some kind of connection, like years later, it's still showing up in these college essays. And I don't think it ever goes away because it impacts the whole community. Here I am 6 years later, and I'm still reading this stuff.
That's incredible.
Okay, so again, this is going to air in a few weeks. I will not use his name, but the shooter's mother was convicted yesterday as we're recording this and is possibly facing, I read, like 15 years in prison. Does this provide any closure or peace for you, the school, the community? Like what does this mean?
I think it is some closure and some peace for sure for everybody. So in Michigan, we have a governor who definitely took on, red flag laws.
Can I just say I am obsessed with your governor? Like I fangirl over Gretchen Whitmer at all opportunities, and I wish she was my governor.
I bet you do. Yeah, she's pretty amazing. And so I think like part of me, there's definitely a relief with the verdict. There's definitely some peace, but because of our political climate right now, especially in Michigan, I think like now's the time to take some drastic action. Like, I think what's really amazing from the jury, they had when the jurors were picked in the newspaper, they had kind of like the background, juror number one, number two, whatever. And they had like 15 together with some alternates. And lots of them have guns, own guns. Lots of them are just hunters. In Michigan, we are a hunting state. We in Oxford, we don't have November 15th off, but the town I student taught in did. It's more in the middle of the state, but so it's common. November 15th is the beginning of deer hunting season, and so it's very common for, places to shut down because hunting season starts. It was just really interesting to me to read the bios for the jurors because they really were like a lot of them own guns, have guns, did hunter safety classes. And, before anything was even said in court, I was like, this is going to be fascinating because, like, this is a demographic that I don't know what's going to happen here. And so once the trial went on, and then they were done with the trial last week, and the judge was going to get the jury going, and really everybody was kind of like, I have no idea. And I paid attention only to what was on the news. I watched Molly with her testimony during the trial, just because she is one of my very good friends. But I was like, I have to remove myself from everything else. And so the only I would see the snippets on the news, the nightly news, and that was really all that I was paying attention to. After everything had wrapped up, there was a lot of like, I have no idea how this is gonna work. There was a lot of, I don't know, is it gonna be a hung jury? Is it, nobody really knew just because the dynamics of the jury, it's like, gosh, it really could go really any way. And so when it was read, there definitely was a huge sigh. I was actually working at the middle school when it came out yesterday, which was, kind of interesting because I was very, really removed then from like my immediate people. And so we're just texting and stuff. So I think there's definite peace. I think there's definite relief on it. But I'm also like, okay, so if this is how these people found her in this climate with their knowledge of guns and gun safety, like maybe now is the time to really make some serious change. That if we have this set of jurors who most of them are very pro-gun and they're willing to see that, yeah, this mom should have done more as a parent and that this should not have happened because a parent should have been paying attention, more attention to what was actually going on, instead of just buying her child a gun. I guess in some ways I'm hopeful of the change that can come, and that doesn't take away, I know, for the four families, I know it doesn't help any of them say they still don't have their child to kiss goodnight. I get that. And that is a horror that I hope to never know. If anything good can come out of this, I think it would just be a change of law and policy.
I have like two trains of thought that I'm trying to keep on parallel tracks. So on the one hand, I didn't know about the jury demographics, and hearing you say this, I think it's astounding that they came to the verdict that they did. But that clearly goes to show that responsible gun owners understand that
That they need to be responsible.
children shouldn't have weapons, that parents who provide those weapons need to be held accountable. Like, this is setting a precedent that I hope we never need to use. This is the first time this has happened. In our situation, the shooter was already 19, so there were no parents to hold accountable. And because of COVID, it delayed the trial for years. And I did not watch. I couldn't bring myself to do it. My coworkers testified. Former students of mine testified. The victim's parents got up and spoke. And I could not watch it because I didn't want to see his face. And they kept panning over, and I didn't want to see fake emotion and him feeling sorry for himself and all of that. So I didn't watch. He got sentenced to life in prison. A lot of people wanted him to get the death penalty. That's not what the judge or the jury, handed to him. Or having that trial, I think at some level provided closure, even if it wasn't the verdict that you had hoped for, at least it's over. And we don't have to hear his name and see his picture and learn about these trial delays over and over and over again. The next step for us will be when the building finally comes down, it's still there. And I see it from my classroom because it's Florida and we're an open campus with 50,000 buildings. So like I open my door and I'm outside and I see that building. I think when it comes down, it won't even provide closure because like you said, those families still don't have their children.
No.
You know, I lost two students, but I knew several others. I lost three coworkers. You know, like it never changes anything. For those of us who remain on campus, and there's about 88 faculty and staff who are still there, who were there that day, those of us in that group, at least it'll make being on campus easier, especially for those of us on that side of campus who see that building every single day. And, you know, I know I grew up in New York. I know that schools up north are typically one large, several story building. So your building won't come down. But I know Amy said that in the time that your school was closed, they redid the hallways and all of that. And I was both shocked and impressed that they got it done so quickly. You know, looking at us now, 6 years later, the building is still there. At some level, we've become kind of this like circus sideshow because people keep coming to tour the building. We've had Miguel Cardona, who's the Secretary of Education. We've had a gajillion lawmakers over the last few weeks walk through the building. And, you know, of course, that's delaying it coming down. But every time people come, it just rips the Band-Aid off again. You know, at least you have, I guess, a clean slate in that way that it was repainted and redecorated. But it's just a Band-Aid on a broken bone because you still know what happened. And unfortunately, these things keep happening. And I think about the piece that you did. I think about the work that Abby, Sari, and I are doing. What do you think that teachers and school staff can do to use their voices in times of tragedy, whether it be school shootings or community gun violence that so many of our students face every day?
Yeah, I think it's just finding an avenue that you're comfortable with. And we have had many teachers kind of become more political in that way through other organizations. And one of the things that really is inspiring to me is how our students are doing that. And so I think a lot of our teachers actually have jumped on board with some of the activism that our own students are doing and kind of using that like, okay, what do you need me as an adult to do to help you guys? And so I think that is kind of the I don't want to say the easiest, but because we're helping students, because we're working directly with students, you know, that's our comfort level in general. And so I think for many teachers, it's kind of just finding those opportunities instead of being political in Lansing. Although some of those groups have gone to Lansing and become political in a way, I think it's trying to do what you can locally and with what you're comfortable with. And I think there are a lot of teachers who have tried to do those kinds of things. And there are others who have kind of decided, you know, like my one friend Lauren, and she's become much more political at the state and federal level in terms of ramping up her activism. As part of it, you know, like we still are seen as teachers. So there's still some things that, you know, we have to, I don't want to say like be careful about, and that's why I feel like being an activist along with NEA and MEA is a safe place for me because I know they're not going to let me do anything that's going to get me into trouble. I think it's just finding what teachers are comfortable with. And there are a lot of people who are willing to help students with their own activism. So I think that's been a safe route in Oxford for teachers to become involved.
I agree. I think everything just kind of exploded after what happened here. That's where March for Our Lives came from. So many teachers jumped in to help the students. Clearly, teachers in our own right have become more involved and have been activists alongside the kids and independent of the kids. But I think a good place, I agree, I think a good place to start is helping the kids, because where we as the adults have failed them, we now can stand with them and work to make the change. I think we also can use our voices within our communities, at school board meetings, to reach out to lawmakers and let them know these things are unacceptable and these are changes that we need to and want to see.
It's been an empowering adventure for me, but one thing that I've really come to appreciate is my girls really, I think, see the power of what I'm doing. So one of my twins is going into education. She's an elementary ed major. And at one point last year, she was like, "I can't do it. I can't do it." Well, if you met my daughter, like, she should be nothing but an elementary teacher.
That's cute.
I think it's been, especially for her, because of the connection with education, it's been very empowering for her to see me now take some of this political limelight, whereas normally it's my husband. And I think that's even with our own family, that's kind of been an interesting shift, that usually he's the one out there speaking and meeting people, and for me, I'm now that person.
You're setting a good example for your girls,
Yeah,
which is important.
and really it's because of them that I was like, "No, I need to do this."
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to follow Teachers Unify to End Gun Violence on Instagram and Threads at Teachers Unify, and follow the podcast on both platforms at Teachers Unify PC.